listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Good to be with you just on the heels of Thanksgiving for many of you. Hopefully those family squabbles over politics and Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court weren't too bad this year, because there was a lot to say after the election. But we have a full show for you today. I'm really excited to bring my guest to you, Dr. Philip Chavez from the Men's Academy.
That's right. It's good to be here.
Now, you've been traversing Rome. So a little later in the show, we're going to talk about a momentous time when you went and visited where Maximilian Kolbe lived.
Sure.
And then we're also going to talk about the Pope Paul VI canonization, which we've actually not talked about yet. He is just a major spiritual father to me, and his writings have been so profound. But also coming up on the show, I don't know if you guys have heard, but Celine Dion. Now, my poor whole family, I don't know how they put up with me. When I was younger, I had this like awesome stereo that I like saved up and bought, and it lit up all these different colors, really loud speakers. And I would blast Celine Dion through the house as I fell asleep at night. And it more recently dawned on me how loud that must have been for the whole house. And I just can't imagine how they put up with that for so long. My brother has a habit of blasting music, too.
Ah, a little competition there.
Now he does. So it's funny. I'm like, man, just lower. I can't imagine how awful mine probably was. But Celine Dion has recently launched with New, a clothing line that is gender neutral for children. Also, Victoria's Secret's supposedly gotten a little bit of backlash as they did an interview with Vogue for not being more inclusive with the different types of identities and diversity that some people think they should. We'll also talk about, I would love to hear what your Christmas and Advent traditions are. We're going to be discussing the underground church in China. We'll be talking about five of the major trends for marriage and family life in the United States, and also how that's changing up a little bit in Hungary and how they've seen a thirding of abortions, so fewer abortions, fewer divorces, more marriages, and how they're seeking to do more to turn around their demographic decline in their country. So you have all of that coming up ahead. Dr. Philip Chavez, I want to start by talking about what's going on with Celine Dion.
Sure.
I just cannot fathom why people are so in favor of creating this gender-neutral clothing that makes it so you look at a kid and you don't know whether it's a boy or a girl. Why?
Yeah, that it's hard to know what these people may be thinking or really what's behind that. But if they're talking about something so gender-neutral like that, there's got to be some kind of struggle within themselves that compassionates with that. In other words, I think she's probably searching somewhat in herself, where she's at in her own life. I'm not sure. I guess the sad thing is that when that's done and you fail to give someone a sex character identity, you fail to give them an identity, as I said earlier. And corresponding with that, if a person doesn't have an identity, they don't really understand their purpose or where they fit or where they're oriented to or where they're going. And so maybe a lot of this gender identity business starts when people themselves don't have a sense of navigation in life. And they feel that something very deep must be discovered or rediscovered. And sex identity is not maybe taken root in them to where they can take a kind of confidence that that is their identity and they can move forward in that. So on one level, too, it's also a great injustice to children to not teach them what their natural identity is and to appreciate that and to embrace that and to live out that and to show the beauty of that and how one can serve and live and thrive in that.
You know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking about how we come to know something too, you know, basic philosophy.
Sure.
You know, we learn about the world around us through our five senses.
Right.
Taste, touch, feel, you know, going through these. And what we're doing with this gender ideology crisis is we're telling kids, you can't know anything.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
You can't know anything about yourself. Your biological sex does not give you any sense of meaning or definition. So if I can't know myself, what can I know?
That's right. And teaching children to deny what's basically what they can sense. I mean, there's clear distinctions and attributes of a woman. There's clear distinctions and attributes and characteristics of a man. And to deny those universals is to teach a child to deny what it clearly sees. And so just even on an intellectual level, you can see that's highly harmful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're stunting the growth of a human person in terms of what they can come to know and understand, which is so interesting because, you know, I think that young people today are brilliant. Just the level of education that they receive and the different things. I mean, just it's incredible seeing my younger siblings who are in high school and just their broad knowledge in different areas. Yet what's scary is when, in general in life, we have all of this information being given to us.
Right.
When the first way to learn about the world, about human development, about human growth interaction is by physically interacting. And that's part of what was so providential about St. John Paul the Great's work is he was a phenomenologist. He told us to look deep into human experience and to extract from that at a time where we were quickly fading away from that natural sense of understanding that we have from our senses.
That's right. And with a natural understanding of relationships and of personhood. But I think this is what you're getting to, is that what good is knowledge just to fill the intellect when in some way just as persons and relationships for which we really should be living for is really not in place. And so, I think the pursuit of knowledge actually can in some respects inhibit the actual pursuit of relationships. Because instead of relating, I think nowadays we're engaged in too many things, maybe even to learn or too many activities. And not sharing enough relational things, say at home and whatnot, dinner table.
Yes, I was just talking to a dear friend. This reminds me of the conversation we were talking about how they're listening to a podcast and how the podcast was talking about how there are so many great books and podcasts and things to listen to. And I mean, people are turning their lives around based on different ideologies from inspirational speakers and educators. And it's fantastic. But the problem is if we become so consumed by learning and the information and we don't go out and live it, whether we live what we learned in a new book, whether something transformed is even a basic novel. You know, the fact that we're relaxing and enjoying the novel, but then also going, well, what did I learn about human interaction from this book? An ideology that is being pushed or a truth that is being lived in these characters.
That's right. That's right. And I think in your generation too, I think one of the reasons why people have become addicted to knowledge almost is because you grew up in a generation too, which said there is no truth. So people of your generations, you finally find all these treasures and it's almost as though you can't get enough of them, right? I find even that with some of the men who follow me and some of my own men's work, they just love hearing more and more about this truths of manliness because it fills up something deep for which they've been lacking in. But again, the difficulty is I think social media and other things have caused us to lose a sense of human relationship and what it is to really interact and to learn based upon relationship and the authority of the one we're speaking with and speaking to.
That is Dr. Philip Chavez. Really kind of this conversation helps us to see why what Celine Dion and her, you know, companions there at New and this gender neutral clothing line are missing. They're sitting here saying, well, let them tell you how they feel. You know, they bring a new order into the world. They have this problem of growth if you're forcing male or female clothing or identity on them. But in reality, just as you and I have been talking about, this knowledge of ourselves, understanding human relationship, being grounded in biology, the way God has created our bodies, is true freedom.
That's right. And to speak again of these gender-neutral clothing lines or aspects of life is to really strip a child of what they own and their natural birthright, which is to grow in their identity. So really, these people are, again, they're doing a tremendous disservice to the young in trying to strip them from identity, strip them from a sense of purpose, strip them from a sense of being in some respect.
And ultimately from the pursuit of what is good.
That's right.
And what is God, right?
That's right.
And so that's even in the men's academy and the work you're doing, you're teaching men to be good men.
That's right. That's right. And then and we exercise our goodness by who we are. And fundamentally, goodness is exercised in relationship and in the interaction of love, which is found in particular ways as feminine and as masculine.
You know,
absolutely.
As we're talking about this, we're talking about identity, right?
Yes.
Who we are. But we're also, what's happening in the culture is that the culture is now saying, or should I say people like Celine Dion and others with political agendas are saying, no, we're not just talking about identity. We're talking about forced diversity now.
Mm, that's right.
So now there's forced diversity. For example, you know, not that I watch the Victoria's Secret fashion show, but it's made it quite a bit into the news recently. In fact, they've had an uptake to the point of 45% increase in eyeballs watching that show. Now, we could get into a whole lot of why Victoria's Secret has almost doubled their numbers in some ways, right? But instead, I can look at it more so. There is an article done by some of the chief executives over at Victoria's Secret with Vogue magazine. And they're kind of dissing some of their competitors a little bit. But what we saw, and again, I'm talking to Dr. Philip Chavez, is there's a push for Victoria's Secret to cave under pressure to diversity. Now, not just among different colored skin, but among different shapes and sizes of models. And I mean, I think some of that is actually a push for authenticity in terms of the body, right?
Sure.
And not overly pressuring women in their bodies. But part of it is like this idea of forced sizes and models. Like, it's just like, for the sake of forcing diversity, for the sake of forcing, people are saying, well, there should be trans people now in the Victoria's Secret fashion show, but they refuse to include that.
Yeah. Well, and I think one reason too is they do have their brand and they stay within a certain limit. So I think good marketing is, as a friend of mine in pharmaceuticals says, well, the reason for my success is that I've narrowed down and targeted what I do. So I think in some respects too, in this case as well, they do have a target market and they just want to reach that market well.
Well, and they emphasize, some of the executives, that quote, the show is a fantasy. Remember this after all. You know, we've got to remember the show is a fantasy. The Victoria's Secret show is, I mean, ultimately a sexual fantasy, right? A
sure.
fantasy of what your body could look like, maybe for women. You know, I mean, there's so much to it that is this fantasy. And it's ironic they have these angelic wings and things.
That's right.
Because there's something of the transcendence of God that they're working toward, even in just the over-sexualization in some ways.
I guess you could say, insofar as maybe there's a certain projection of a certain perfection of how a woman ought to look. So there's something about seeking for something more perfect beyond yourself. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Of course, I always thought that was one of the harmful things about some of these fashion magazines and whatnot for women, is because in some way it communicates to women, you're not pretty enough. You're not good enough. And I think that in some way could bring out some negativity about a woman's self-identity. But in part of that article, which you had me review, wasn't there a part, and I forget who is exactly speaking of this element, where they do want women to feel, they do want to, even though they have a limited market, they do want to feel, let women feel, by the way they're branding things now, that they can be acceptable. They are acceptable of themselves.
Absolutely. We're talking about the Victoria's Secret executive interview with Vogue magazine. And yes, they're kind of trying to emphasize that, yeah, you know, we're not forcing that uber skinny type of model anymore. And they talk about how, in fact, more of our models are more physically fit than they were before. And now it's actually turned into a competition for who's going to be in
right,
it
yes.
because they're focusing on exercise. And this is even a trend that I have seen in the dancing world, because this is where my background came from. And that it used to be, I remember when I was very young, my some of my teachers and even my mom preparing me that there's going to be pressure on you and your body to have that anorexic, very bony look. And, you know, part of it's how our bone structure is developed. There are certain dance companies that I would probably never be able to dance with because maybe I wasn't a certain height, or, you know, I always feel like I have a larger rib cage in comparison to what the expectation is for a tiny waist, say, for a dancer. And so, you know, there are always these challenges. But today in the dancing world, this fit body structure, differentiation in sizes, tall, short, whatever it might be, is something you see as more accepted now than it ever was before.
That's good. That's good. I could see that that's a good thing. It's interesting how people nowadays, especially the young people, I know that they don't want to be told what they should be, or they don't want to be pointed out that they should be something else. Last night I was with my niece and my sister-in-law, and my sister-in-law made a comment about her, and she said, you know, Mom, you're projecting on me. In other words, kids today, I don't think they really want to be told what they're not, or what they could be, or the way they should be. They want to be accepted for who they are.
Where they're at.
Yeah, where they're at.
And there's such a longing for that. And I think that that's something, although we might see it in different forms of art is being more accepted, in mainstream media, you know, things like the camera adds 10 pounds to the way you look in your body. And so this expectation is very different, say, within specifically TV and the movie industry. As we heard last week, we were talking about Lily Reinhart and how she's, you know, promoted as Woman of the Year by Glamour, but she pushes back talking about her own struggle with this pressure on her body. And so as we're talking about diversity, it becomes about, for some reason, transgenderism rather than the struggle for women in their own identities and their bodies.
Sure. Sure.
It's just, see how that's just pulled right from underneath, like talking about something we need to discuss to suddenly we're talking about transgenderism.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to comment on that entirely, but it is the case too. I think there's so many influences, again, for women, which help them or try to influence them to think that you're not where you're at or where you're supposed to be, or there's something better for you. And I think inherently women resist that.
You know, something I want to talk about is we're talking about, you know, this push for diversity in fashion shows. We're hearing for this push for gender neutral clothing. I look at who in many ways is suffering, you know, the young, and we can't even know who we are anymore. Women who were reduced to materialism, men, they've lost their identity. And I think about the work of Pope Paul VI and the last encyclical he ever wrote, although he was a pope for much longer after that, in Humanae Vitae, and how he talked about this ideology of contraception and how it would lead ultimately not only to the turning of women into material means to be sought after, but to the point of seeing that we are just destroying human life and manipulating it with, you know, population control, forced population control. And it was so providential what he said, because it came true. It was prophetic. Right. And I think as we're dealing with all of these issues, Pope Paul VI was just canonized a pope this year.
That's right.
In the midst of a year where the conversation over abortion is just so rampant. The conversation over identity is just horrific in the country and worldwide, especially in the West. And yet here we have a saint that we know now is interceding for us in heaven.
Right.
And you had the blessing of being at his canonization.
That's right. I was there. It was a powerful time. He was canonized with Oscar Romero, who years back was a controversial figure, but certainly his sanctification vindicates him on that respect. But there were five others as well. And it was a packed piazza. Yeah, St. Peter's was full. And it was a real powerful time. But yeah, Paul VI, there's much to be said about him in terms of his foresight. But certainly, I mean, I think everything is hinged upon, as we're talking about, the proper and true understanding of human sexuality. And if that is not in place, and a respect for that and a veneration for that in marital relations, then so much will break down. And women will be objectified, yes. They will be, in marriages, spouses will start to cheat on each other, and there will be moral degradation generally.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, perhaps the real prophetic part of this, even more so, is that governments would come in and actually mandate things against the norms of human life and true norms of human sexuality, which in some ways kind of, maybe at that time, may have looked a little bit presumptuous or something, but he was spot on.
And one of those dramatic conspiracy theories that, boy, has it come true, looking at not just China, but India, the preferential treatment for having girls rather than boys. I have a friend who her mother flew from India to have an abortion, a late term abortion here in the United States. And by the grace of God, there was a sidewalk counselor out in front of that abortion clinic. That girl, they were able to convince the mom, just wait a few more weeks, give a natural birth, and we will have someone, a family here ready to adopt that child. And they did. She's a living testament.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Living testament. She was actually born on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade.
Oh my.
Ironically. But you know, we see India, again, if you're looked down upon, if you have girls, China,
That's right.
Preferential treatment for boys as well, forced sterilization and forced abortions taking place.
That's right.
And we see this government forcing, where also it's an ideology that, for example, in Iceland, they've gotten rid of Down syndrome. They hardly have any children at all born with Down syndrome, not even for a year in their country. And we're seeing where it truly is population control.
It is. And again, these are the inevitable, if I'll use the word fruits, of what it is to have a misplaced
rotten
understanding
fruits.
Of human sexuality and of the family and its true end toward the family.
Later on in the show, we're going to be talking about what are the challenges here in the country and what are we seeing, for example, in Hungary as an example that maybe our government isn't enforcing to protect life and family, but that we ourselves can promote within our own communities as well. Now, for me, really exciting year. I, you know, have my own space now and I'm getting ready to get married next year and I'm excited to have my first Christmas tree all to myself. I think
good.
In college we set one up, but I'm sitting here reflecting on Advent and Christmas traditions.
Sure.
And if you're listening, I would love for you to tell me whether it's the joyful celebrations or the ways you practice spiritual growth, what you do in your home and your prayer life. But is there anything special that you, Dr. Chavez, have?
You know, it's interesting. When I grew up, I remember my mother, especially when I was young, 3, 4, I remember her starting the Advent wreath and putting it on the dining room table. And of course, little boys are fascinated by fire anyways, you know, so it was kind of cool. And one of us even got to lit the candles. But as you lit only one candle and the three were empty, you thought, huh, when are those going to be lit? So there was a sense of anticipation that those will be lit. And so the Advent wreath was just even for a child to know that, hey, something's coming. I mean, when this thing is full, what's going to really happen here? But what's interesting, Timory, is as I was thinking about this, again, I thought that was kind of cool. I mean, I didn't understand the greater meaning of it. I mean, generally, I know its connection with Christmas. But I did think it was kind of cool. And it was a forum by which we gathered around and a forum which did target toward Christmas. What happened was I remember when I was a young boy, I forget how old, I might have been 10 or more or less, my mother took it off the dining room table and she put it on, I don't know, not a shelf, but some other bureau or something where the creche was going to be set up. So it was taken out of the center where the family gathers for dinner. Are you following me here? So it became a real centerpiece for the family and it was taken off the dinner table. And I think what happened, if my memory serves me, maybe one or two seasons did it last and then we got rid of it entirely. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that it was very efficacious and very moving and stirring and engaging when we actually had it at the center of the dining room table, which in some ways is the center of family life. Mm-hmm. And so when it was there, we held fast to it and it had meaning. Because I remember leaving lighting the candles when it was off the dinner room table, didn't have that we it lost its meaning somehow.
Yeah. It wasn't the heart of what the preparation, you know, it wasn't a part, you know, our meals are so important as families, or even having those meals really points to the small church, the breaking of the bread, the fellowship, the communion. And that becomes liturgical when we invite prayer into that gathering of more than just two people or so.
That's right. That's right. Yes, I can't even begin to even in my own life, really come to grips with, in some way, the preparation for the Advent season. Because unfortunately, I think the traditions that are bad is that we have celebrations for Christmas during the Advent season, when we're supposed to be celebrating, you know, during Christmas time.
There's a reason that the priest wears the purple like
That's
Lent
right.
at Advent. I actually, probably about close to 8 or so years ago, I started going on an annual retreat at Advent and out in the desert. And it has been such a special time for me because what I learned was that Advent is a period of repentance, preparing
That's right.
the way, like John the Baptist talks so much about going out into the desert, taking that moment. You know, we give things up during Lent. And we can also offer things up during Advent. And
That's
so for
right.
me, I've taken on the practices in many ways of Lent in joyful anticipation of the coming of Christ. And it has been really transformational. And yeah, there may be celebrations as Advent season is going, but turning toward those has really transformed that spiritual season.
That's good. Yeah. And even for myself, Timory, you know, it is true that, yes, as the priests wear purple and the liturgical color is purple, it is a time for penance and preparation. You know, I found myself, too, it's good to have these communal things to exercise. I think they're important. But it is for personal penance is also something that's incumbent upon us as Catholics. It's an obligation. And to the extent that we can move into that spirit, it can be very helpful in our spiritual lives.
Coming up, we will be discussing a little bit about Maximilian Kolbe and the underground church in China.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Dr. Philip Chavez of the Men's Academies, great to have you here with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You were making a final comment about Advent and that celebration going forward, or more so the lack of celebration, more so the observance of preparing for the coming of Christ in our lives.
Yes, what I find in my own life, yes, in that preparation, there are many things that could be done, prayers and other things and devotions, and I think it is good to do some reading. However, also penance is a really important part of that. Now, what I've found in myself, and I've seen in others too, and I think this has been helpful to them, many of us don't have those disciplines for those penances. In other words, we can make these resolutions and we often break them. And even so now at the beginning of the Advent season, the Christmas season, I may have some ideas what I want to do, but I ask the Lord to present the penance and to teach me how to submit to that. In other words, so I find myself doing and performing penances that he provides instead of the ones I invent. And I find that submission and again, a real spiritual awakening, not just, Lord, just supply these and let me go my way. No, but being very conscientious that when he does supply them and I receive them and I move through them, I think that's a good, I don't know, it's a good thing in his sight.
That takes the formation of a contemplative spirit and being able to, maybe you can't slow down the pace of your life. Mm-hmm. I think most of us in America should, right?
That's
but
right.
We can slow down how we're receiving things, how we're working through them, how we're being watchful of what's around us. Because I think our Lord offers us so many opportunities to be conformed to the body and blood of Jesus Christ.
That's right.
Through offering up our sacrifices throughout the day.
Yeah. And you know, and we talk about God's will in all this. Well, God's will in great measure is what he puts before you. And so to surrender to that and be grateful for that, whatever it is, especially he gives us that which really helps us conform to the image of his son, which we're ultimately really called.
In that prayer, I was talking to someone recently, they were talking about how, you know, it's not just to do the will of God, but to live it, that my will is not separate from his will. So even,
that's,
you know,
right,
picking up this water bottle to the right of me, that I'm living in conformity with God as I'm doing each movement of my body, of my thought, intellect, will, all in conformity with his will.
That's right.
And having that perpetual awareness of God really transforms the way we accept the burdens throughout our day.
That's right. And I think understanding, too, that will and those burdens and all that really is the burden and the will of his son. You know, it's not so matter of much about what we go through, but it's about what he went through. And when we're invited into his life and our and not ours, we know that we're moving through him, with him, and in him. And in that spirit, I think we could find the best peace.
Absolutely. So you recently were in Rome, and I was asking for the highlight of your trip before the show today, and you mentioned you visited where Maximilian Kolbe lived.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I only heard about this spot, well, actually I heard many years ago, but the gentleman that told me, I actually asked him where it was, and he gave me the address, and I followed it up, and it was a street I'd passed by several times. Maximilian Kolbe earned a doctorate in theology and philosophy from the Gregorian University. So he spent many years in Rome. And he had to get to know much about that Roman experience, which myself, I did too. And I learned much about the church and the dynamics surrounding the church, which he did too. And there were a number of things that changed and marked his life while he was in Rome, seeing the decline of the faith, the growth of certain movements, which were harming the faith and harming society generally. And in that Roman stay, he grew in a devotion to the Blessed Mother, as seeing her as the real channel of the Holy Spirit moving through the world and helping us all conform to Jesus Christ. What's interesting, at the monastery, though, which I visited, I saw the chapel which he prayed in, and actually the room that he slept in, which in those days they shared it with other friars. So that must have been a sacrifice of itself. But he started the mission for the Immaculate in this collegio, with other brothers who were some, I'm sure most of them were students at the time. I'm not sure how many were seminarians and priests. But it was interesting. It's marked right there on the balcony of that college. the center of Rome. Actual Romulus and Remus lived allegedly in that zone. But anyways, it's marked as being the center of Rome. And he really believed that if he could start a movement for the Immaculate Heart of Mary right there in the center of Rome, that would diffuse, you know, centrally and disperse throughout the entire world. And so it was just powerful being at that spot, being present there. I have a devotion to Maximilian Kolbe for the life that he lived, the sacrifice he eventually made in Auschwitz, and for his doctrine on the role of the Blessed Mother in the world.
And what a fantastic model, looking to St. Maximilian Kolbe. Has a wonderful devotion to Our Lady, but ultimately, for those who don't know, a reminder, World War II priest captured at Auschwitz ends up offering his life for another person who has a family and is about to be taken away to be killed. And he says,
That's
no,
right.
offer me.
That's right.
Offer me instead. And the guards and different people around him were incredibly transformed
That's
and
right.
impacted by his sacrifice. And, you know, I look, and this is a sacrifice as we're discussing all these different difficult issues from marriage and family. We're going to be talking about the crisis of the church in China. And ultimately, Jesus Christ showed us the example of the Christian lifestyle. That is total life-giving, self-giving love.
That's right.
And that's that self-discipline, that rigor, and that sacrifice. Not that the Christian lifestyle is something to be, you know, just glamorized, but it's something that we are taking on as a responsibility with joy.
That's right. That's right. And really, that responsibility with joy only happens because we're moving in Christ, knowing that we're anchored in Him. I think it is more about, and even the Catechism alludes to this, it's not so much Christ moving in us, but it's more about us moving in Christ. And then when we know it's about His journey and not ours, then we're able to follow that, I think, with more strength. And so when things befall us that are hard, we must understand, well, that's what Christ suffered, but He's asking us to carry that. And I think only peace is really found in that.
Talking about burdens and really carrying the cross of Christ, we're reading right now about the controversy taking place with the church in China. Christianity for many years in China has really been an underground movement unless sanctioned and in submission to the Chinese government, the same government that has a policy that you must kill your children and sterilize your own body, again, to the point where women are committing suicide at a rate of 500 women a day. It is not a hopeful place in China, and there's been much controversy over agreements between the Chinese government and the Vatican over the appointment of bishops to try and allow for an above ground Christianity to take place in China. Yet the challenge is there's a lot of controversy, and Cardinal Zen has really come out pointing that as these agreements are taking place, priests are still being punished and being forced underground, and they don't know what's going on, what's legal.
That's right. And it's confusing, I think, because first of all, they don't know what is being said and what really happened, I mean, at least in their details, but they also don't know what the intentions of the Vatican are and what they're really trying to achieve. Now, the Vatican will say general things like, well, this is for, how the Holy Father put it, for the spread of the growth in Jesus Christ and for unity amongst the faithful. The problem is, I think, is some of these faithful priests and laity in the underground church, there is no unity in the sense that those in the patriotic Catholic Church are in the state institutionalized church follow a whole different set of rules. And so there is no, you may say there's some unity in Christ, but there's really no unity in belief. So I think what's happening is it's confusing the faithful. It's confusing the priests who've made these great sacrifices. And yet what? Now we're talking to you as they're processing it. What? Now that we're asked to what? Follow or be united with those in the government-run church? That's unintelligible to them.
And the priests who are underground are being forced to have quote-unquote certificates in order to live or practice the faith in the public life. So what we're seeing is that priests are being taken captive. They're having to fight to find their own escape and freedom. They're hiding. They're disappearing because, unfortunately, the reality is that it's still the government trying to manipulate Christianity within their country. And
yeah, that's right. And it goes even beyond the priests and those exercising the faith. It goes, they even target their relatives and whatnot and punish them through them.
Yeah, and we're just talking about the bearers of Christ's sacrament. So think about this bigger picture. We're talking about you and I, everyday laity individuals who do not have the gift of being able to receive our Lord in the sacraments every day in the Eucharist, who don't have the opportunity for reconciliation,
right,
who are being deprived of their desiring baptism, but they're being neglected because the government is forcing, you know, a state institutionalized religion on the people.
That's right. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I really don't know how to comment in terms of what's going to happen in the future here, because you can see some very deeply problematic things with the government now appointing bishops. And certainly I don't understand how the Vatican confirmation works and all that. But, you know, the Chinese church, to the extent that it has been enduring, has a certain strength and resilience about it. You know, it's interesting, and I don't know if you've noticed this, Timory, but I find that when people from China or some of these other Oriental countries embrace the faith, they actually are very strong believers. And I'm very confident that as things get to be worked out, that these priests who have sacrificed so much will figure out a way how to stand strong in the faith and to still lead their flocks with the strength they have in the past.
I think this is what the great testament of the Catholic Church in China shows us, is that it is underground. And they're having to live their faith with extreme rigor. And I've been talking a lot about fear recently and how we are afraid of what grows us and challenges us most. Mm. And you know, sometimes we're even afraid of hearing about Christian persecution in other countries.
Sure.
And I think it's because we're afraid of even standing up for our own faith in a free world.
That's
in,
right,
you know, America, where we have the sacraments and access to our faith every day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know... I know in a man's perspective, you know, it's persecution or it's rigor that's really toughens us up and kind of gives us some motivation. And so I think for the persecuted church, this is that persecution in some ways made them strong. Here where we exercise so much freedom, we've become a little soft about our faith and defending it and exercising.
That's Dr. Philip Chavez. We'll be right back coming in talking about some comments of the five trends in the marriage and family life movements, both in here in the United States and in Hungary.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
There's a recent article that came out by Mark Reineris, and he's one who is the author of that book, Cheap Sex. And he talks about how in our world today, sex is cheap. It's accessible very easily. Yet one of the major points, I did an interview for him a while back when I was helping fill in for the Patrick Coffin show. He was talking about how ultimately women in many ways are a kind of that final battle, specifically for men. If women are willing to have sex, men are going to have it. But if women aren't willing to have sex and men aren't going to have it, you know, for the most part, really interesting points in his book. And that always really stood out to me. And I bring it up now of as a side river here breaking off, because it was so challenging to hear, like, yes, there's responsibility on both sides, but there's a great level of respect men have for women. And when called and challenged by that, they will, most cases, stand up to it.
I think so. And in some way, yes, a woman's disposition toward chastity is somewhat the barometer of the relationship, interestingly enough. Because a man, he's disposed in his respect for her to kind of yield in some way to where she's at. Mm. It's kind of an interesting dynamic between the sexes that may be hard for women to understand.
And it's frustrating. I remember when I first heard it, I remember interviewing it. I cut into the interview. Don and I were interviewing. I'm like, wait, what? Oh, come on, you know? Because we'd love to have this mindset, especially in the United States, where everything's 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
Although we agree that we are equal in dignity, but we are different in creation and identity, right?
That's right.
But we want the weight and expectations to always be 50-50, but in reality, it's not.
In reality, it's not. And one of the reasons, Timory, that theologians may account for this, and I studied this during my own doctoral dissertation, one aspect of sexuality is women in the marital act have more to lose. Okay, they have more at stake. And so there's one theological principle that says because they have more at stake, it's more incumbent upon them morally to not just live a chaste life, but to observe. There's a greater level of expectation to observe modesty. So there's certainly equality in so much as both must follow the moral order, but it's more incumbent upon women to live a more modest life than it is for men. because the nature that there is more to lose.
Well, and look at what we've lost as women in our society, the chemical manipulation of our bodies, the tendency toward cancer, blood clotting, et cetera, through contraception, yeah. You know, the devastation of physically having lost our motherhood through abortion, the forced abortions in China. We could go on and on. And yes, it is women who are the ones who are often abused emotionally, physically, through the liberation of sexuality.
That's right. So
although it's hard to swallow, it's a calling, not that we should look at, you know, chastity as 50-50 in our relationships, but that I am doing my absolute best no matter what.
That's right.
And I'm challenging others to that as well.
Yeah. And there's something to respect in the differences about how one exercises that. And I think a man is more appreciative, too, of a woman who's more keen to those obligations. Mm. You know, there's something about equality that it's harder to love in equality. We love more when in otherness. We love because there is other. We appreciate, respect, and venerate because something is other than ourselves.
Right.
And it's really, it's otherness that makes romance and life a beautiful thing. It's not sameness.
Well, and that's sometimes a great shock of marriage for people today. I remember there was a piece, I think, that Chris Mueller and I did on the show about 6 months ago. And this one woman was talking about, these are the things I never knew. Like, I had no idea what I was getting into when I got married. Mm. And she talks at one point how there are a lot of times where there is no 50-50. There is no equality here. There are days where I've got almost nothing to give and the other person's holding up what
That's
needs
right.
to be done and vice versa. Or maybe I'm giving it 20 and he's giving it 80 or,
That's
you know,
right.
the opposite, that there are days that is life. That's why we take the vows to death to do us part through the good and the bad and
That's
through
right.
our own weaknesses.
And really to not look it through it in the sense that, as long as we pull in equally and share each other's resources equally and everything is equal, that doesn't usually end well.
I think it's
when somebody has a complete disposition of self-sacrifice, that's when it really works.
Otherwise, that's a bribe. Quid pro quo,
right?
I scratch your back, I
that's
get this,
right.
you get that. Or maybe if we're more official, we'll put it down on contracts. But that's
right.
also what some prostitutes do too, right?
Mm-hmm.
You give me this, I'll give you that.
Yes.
But I want to talk about Mark's five insights as to kind of what are some of the ideologies or what are we seeing in the country right now? And these are all the topics we've been discussing on the show. But I want to go a little bit into some of them very briefly. The first one is that same-sex marriage became the law of the land in all 50 states through a Supreme Court decision, and how that has changed the dynamic of suddenly, if we look at it from a cultural perspective, I think it's over 30 of the states had voted over the last 15, 20 years, even the last 9 years, to make marriage between one man and one woman and making that amendment to the Constitution, yet the Supreme Court overruled all of that. Well, suddenly, what was a natural instinct of our country of marriage between being between one man and one woman has now, with the changing of a law, has told people what is legal is what is moral.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing the trendingness of the transgender movement.
Sure.
As that second thing that Mark points to. And the third thing, we'll pause after this, is how queer is now mainstream.
Yeah.
And, you know, we look at this, thoughts here.
Which queer is now means almost any kind of sexual expression or deviation or whatnot, or whatever one holds to be their own gender identity. So even that's become so amorphous and without real distinction, that term.
You know, we look at it, trans is okay, queer is fine, bisexual is all fine. You know, this whole LGBTQ movement, I could go on 27 plus letters, but the reality is they're saying you swing that way, you swing that way, it doesn't matter, everything's fine. And we've seen as, you know, my childhood stars that I saw growing up, remember, I think Raven Simone was another one of them, you know, from The Cosby Show and That's So Raven, these different shows of, oh yeah, I'm bi, you know, everything's acceptable. There is no truth. And we started today talking about how with these gender clothing lines, we're saying there is no such thing as truth.
That's right. And as it holds within the area of sexuality, there's no truth about sexuality that really is ordered toward the beginning of life and really the building of families, which needs to be more the end of marriage. And I think we've lost a sense of marriage because we don't see it now so much as the institution for the building of sound families. Marriage is seen now a contract between two persons who want to cohabitate.
Right. Well, and that's just it. Going to the fourth thing that Mark points to is he talks about how A lot of people are cohabitating. Sure. Yes, some people are married. But guess what? My generation, actually the millennial generation, is having less sex than any of the previous generations. If you look back 70 years or further back,
that's interesting.
The reality is we have decreased libido because of hormonal contraception, antidepressants, ADD, ADHD medications, you name it. People are depressed. Their bodies chemically not ovulating, not interested in having sex. Pornography stimulating our own type of fantasy and pleasure. Sure. You know, this is, I think we've made sex cheap. It's not all that it was made up to be, because we're clearly having less of it in less committed and loving relationships.
And can it be the case too, Timory, that that is so because the loss of a sense of what it is to be feminine, what it is to be a masculine, the role of a man, a role of a woman, which also plays in that too. And so, you know, young men today, especially in their 20s and early 30s, they don't know what a man is. They don't know what they're supposed to do. They don't know how they're supposed to conduct themselves. They're very unsure, very tentative, very tenuous. And so I find that that all plays into it as well. So we're going to see lower marriage rates insofar as couples struggle, or rather individuals struggle with their own identity as male or as female. Absolutely.
And there is a great hope and opportunity, because we see these trends are not trends that make us happy.
That's
even
right.
You know, the last one is, again, the decrease in divorce, but the divorce rates are decreasing because people just aren't getting married now.
That's right.
Or people are getting married who have more money. It's become this question I ask. It's an elitist mentality who marries now, unfortunately. But we see in Hungary, for example, they looked at their population. Their population was on the decline. Abortion numbers were off the charts. Divorces were up. And in 10 years, they were able, from 2007 to 2017, completely turn their country around. They have dropped abortions by a third. Divorces are down. Marriages are up. Young people are marrying. And it's because they're encouraging tax breaks for families to get married young, to have families.
And to own a home,
and
which is huge.
And to own a home, yeah.
It's very emasculating for a man to get married and not really have that ability to provide a home and the means of living for his wife. It's very hard for a man. In fact, I think that's why in the minority communities, because men are incapable or rendered in some way finding that very difficult, that's why they retreat from the homes.
It shows the importance. And again, not that men are the only, men are meant to be providers.
Yes.
Hands down. That doesn't mean that women can't work, but men have, no matter what, to have this sense of being able to provide.
That's right.
And this is something that we have to respect as women and uphold and begin to develop and encourage. Well, how is that going to be done with our young men in the future so that they can develop and flourish?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, in certain countries in Europe, too, it's hard for men to find the jobs that are not as preferred. In fact, I know of a case of a man in Italy. Two of his friends jumped off bridges because they couldn't find jobs. So it's actually a very suicidal situation for some.
Well, and this is why you are fighting at the Men's Academy.
That's right.
For men. You're saying we need to develop men. We need to reach them right where they're at and call them to more.
That's right.
And, you know, as we're looking at different people this week, earlier in the week, you just show with me with Milo Yiannopoulos, where we're talking about him, and he's looking for authentic masculinity, a calling to that. So where can people go to encourage the men in their lives, the young men, or maybe themselves in this journey?
Well, they go to my website, mensacademy.org, and find various resources. But I encourage a download of one recording I have to help men understand the fullness of masculinity in just 1 hour.
So that's available there at the Men's Academy. If you've enjoyed the show, you can reach me at radiotrending.com. Share different things you'd love to hear. Also, you can reach me on Twitter and Instagram at Timory. I will be back next week.
This has been Trending with Timory. To book her to speak or learn more about her guest, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.